Museums bring in guest speakers all the time. Scholars, artists, everything under the sun. Often it takes a lot of publicity to get people engaged and build the audience. That was not exactly the case when we invited experimental philosopher, or should I say, self-proclaimed experimental philosopher Jonathan Keats to visit Philbrook. Here are just a few actual comments from the Facebook event page.
Really? I can't believe as a serious arts institution you would give a platform to mentally ill fraud.
I am personally disappointed that you cannot see the difference between a con man and a true philosopher.
Sure, he might seem ridiculous if you assess his work at the surface level, but one must look deeper to arrive at interesting points, questions that become points, or vice versa. Art that persuades one to think sounds great.
There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Jonathan Keats is a writer, a critic, an artist, and yes, an experimental philosopher. He's tackled a wide variety of conceptual art projects, including selling real estate in space and creating welcome mats for aliens. But we'll get to all that in a little bit. When did you make the decision to adopt the moniker of experimental philosopher?
I never really knew what it was that I did in any sense of any term that corresponded with it, and always sought to do things in a way that would avoid any kind of label. So my background is in philosophy, and coming into college and discovering that philosophy was not what I had naively believed it to be, namely sort of this general Socratic approach to the world, but rather was a highly rigorous and technical and generally hermetic pursuit. And having gone through that training, I came out into the world wanting to find some way in which to do philosophy as I had believed it was done before I got into that, because it seemed to me that in spite of all of the tools that you could gain hold of through academic training in philosophy, there still was some essential role that philosophy could play in society and that it needed to play in society that was not being fulfilled by philosophy and academia. Namely, that there needed to be, and I think still needs to be, some means by which to activate conversation, to get people out of their underlying assumptions and to think more broadly, more philosophically about the world in which they live as well as themselves. So I've, ever since graduation, sought to do that in public in ways and in spaces that would engage as many people as possible. And that has worked out often to be within the art world.
You talked about growing up and kind of having this idea of what a philosopher was. It does seem to be a term that, unfortunately, people think of mostly in the past tense. You know, it would be very difficult for, I would imagine, for the average person, if you said, name your favorite three living philosophers, it would be very difficult for someone to do. And this is not unlike other things like poetry, for example. This is a thing where maybe 150 years ago, people could easily name four or five major poets who are living. But it's very difficult for people to do that now. And I wonder, when you were growing up, did you have any current contemporary role models in society, in public life, that you viewed as philosophers, even if they didn't name themselves that way, meaning writers, people just commenting on culture? Who did you kind of look to in contemporary life as a younger person that would emulate these things?
I don't think that there was such a role model. And I think that that may be partly why I went about trying to build the life that I have. Not that I should be the role model for anyone on anything, but rather that there seems to be this gap in our society, which has in many respects become more professionalized, more practical, yet also some aspect of it, which was where thought took place to a large extent, has become more academic and therefore more inaccessible. There's more of a divide as time goes on, and that's understandable. I think in any academic pursuit, you need to recognize what has happened in the past and to build on that. And as a result, in the sciences, most obviously perhaps, to do experiments that would have been done 100, 200 years ago, that doesn't make sense. You need to be operating at a level of specialization that is highly inaccessible to most people. And philosophy has followed an equivalent course. And so certainly growing up, I didn't encounter philosophers because that's the state that philosophy was in. I certainly encountered philosophers in a more mythic sense, that is to say, the story of Socrates, for instance. And also, I think another area that really was influential to me was Jewish thought. I was raised Jewish in a very secular way, but always had, and ever more so, I've had an interest in Talmud, in the process of asking questions on the basis of whatever answers you might come to, whatever conclusions you might come to, that they only are worthwhile, only worthy to the extent that they open up larger questions.
Yeah, and you've written, I believe you wrote a book of fables that based on some of those pursuits early on. Your father was a stockbroker, if I'm correct. Is that right?
He was initially, yes, and then he became an art dealer, dealing exclusively with dead artists, which maybe isn't such a bad idea.
And was there a time in your life when you thought you might go down that path of a stockbroker as well? You know, did you ever have a moment where you had these kind of divergent paths that you could have ended up going down?
I think that I was always headed down the same path regardless of what I thought I was doing. That is to say, perhaps my first project as an experimental philosopher, as an artist, before I really had any notion of those terms or what they might entail, was selling rocks. I set up a table in the suburban neighborhood in Marin County, California, where I grew up, and tried to sell rocks to people passing by that were the same as all the rocks that were all around me. And that was certainly at some level learning from or observing or trying to comprehend what it is that my father did and to do that, to enter into the world of commerce.
How much would a rock run me? When would this have been? Give me a time frame.
This was around 1976, 1977.
So what's a rock from Jonathan Keats going to cost me in 1976?
Well, it was always a penny.
Matter the size or anything.
I always took that for rocks and for anything else that I sold in that vein.
That seems
I
also like a good deal.
Sold water and more or less anything else that had no inherent value yet that could have any value assigned to it whatsoever. So in a sense, looking back on it, I think that it was an attempt at coming to terms with where value comes from and what it means to enter into a financial relationship, what it means to buy and to sell, and the fact of those rocks having been there long before I was and being there long after I will be is one of the many paradoxes inherent in this idea of ownership. And I don't think I would have articulated it that way. In fact, I'm certain that I wouldn't have at the time, but this was my way of exploring the world through these interactions, through these transactions. And the choice of 1 cent was simply a choice of what was the least amount of money.
To make it in a transaction, an actual
exactly.
transaction.
And then what came out of it was really in the interactions that took place, people who were incredulous. And this was, I think it may actually have been around the same period as the pet rock was invented.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Do you view that concept in some ways as a work of conceptual art, the idea of the pet rock, when we think about it now, 45, 50 years on since its creation?
It was, in fact, invented right down the road from where I was selling my rocks, as it turns out. It was in Los Gatos, California, and I had no notion of it at the time. This is not a matter of anxiety of influence here. Mm. I don't think that was influencing anything that I did at the time. But to me, the pet rock is an absolutely fascinating work to consider, and I do consider it to be perhaps one of the great conceptual artworks of its age, not because it was intended as such, and to me that doesn't really ultimately matter, but because at a much larger level, enlisting all sorts of mechanisms beyond those at my own disposal, such as marketing and packaging, it really was asking a lot of very interesting questions, either intentionally or inadvertently, and bringing about a conversation that was, I think, incredibly powerful, incredibly useful for society to have.
There's an inherent humor to the concept, too, that I wonder, when you have something like the idea of you're going to have a rock as a pet, it's inherently funny, but it also does, at the same time, run on a parallel track of you deciding, well, can anything I say be a pet of mine? And if I take care of something and treat it in a certain sense, can an inanimate object or anything be considered a pet, and who gets to decide that? So those two things are happening at once. You know, people were making fun of it, but at the same time thinking about things differently. And a lot of times it seems like those two things happen a lot concurrently. Things getting misunderstood, which then leads to ridicule or jest, but then at the same time forcing people to think about things differently, which then makes them uncomfortable, which then leads them to ridicule and jest. And I think those things are always intertwined.
Certainly, humor is, I think, an essential way in which to go about the process of thinking and standing back from everyday necessities and everyday assumptions, because that really is a circumstance in which you are off guard. And so the fact of the pet rock being a novelty that's funny, that you just buy it on a whim, I think allows a lot of people who might otherwise consider themselves to be very serious and as a result of that perhaps to be rather closed-minded to enter into some sort of a conceit that throws out into the open a lot of the systems that are built into our society. There's the humor that gives you license to do something you otherwise wouldn't, to even talk about things you otherwise wouldn't in ways that you might not otherwise do. But also there is the absurdity inherent in the exercise itself. And to me, absurdity is really one of the most powerful tools that we have, philosophically speaking, for exploring the world.
You're thinking of, like, in the tradition of the theater of the absurd and things like that, where people are pushing the boundaries of what is, because it's not quite farce and it's not satire. It's something else beyond that.
And I think that I'm not even thinking of the theater of the absurd. That certainly is one instantiation of it. But I think that it goes back much farther than that. I think that it runs much deeper than that. I think that absurdity is sort of a parallel world to ours, a sort of a funhouse mirror reflection.
Like the Superman Bizarro World kind of thing where everything's inverted slightly.
Yes, that certainly would be yet another. I don't know that that has ever been put into the same paragraph as Theater of the Absurd. But yes,
until
absolutely. I think that there's a larger pattern that emerges when you put those together, and that it pertains also to the world of myth, the world of legend, the world of storytelling, the way in which you create some sort of a world that is perhaps like ours in most ways, but in some way is different, and that difference provides some sort of a probe, some mechanism by which we can look at our world. And that can be done in a mythic style that may not be funny in any way, but myth perhaps has some absurdity built into it in terms of that shift and in terms of, first of all, the fact that you can undertake a sort of a thought experiment, which has really been crucial to a lot of what I've gained from philosophy and what I've done ever since, but also from the standpoint of having some space you can enter into outside of the world as ordinarily lived that provides a vantage for looking at the world as ordinarily lived. I think that the reason why storytelling has been so persistent and why so much was expended on storytelling way back when, a time when perhaps the resources involved were considerable, was to do with the fact that it was a space for being able to look at the everyday and to do so without the everyday necessities that were precluding some sort of a larger assessment.
Well, you know, Joan Didion has that very famous opening line to her book, The White Album, which says, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live." But in some ways, you're kind of making the point that, you know, we use narrative and we tell stories not just to live, but to understand, or at least attempt to understand, this place, this world, this universe, this whatever. Has myth and story been as important to your development as traditional philosophy, I guess, and using stories?
Absolutely. At every level, I've found narrative to be essential in terms of my own development and also in terms of what I do. I think that the ability to construct and to explore some alternate reality is perhaps one of the most significant phenomena of the human mind that has led us to be able to achieve what we can, and yet at the same time that is perhaps underexploited today in terms of getting outside of some of the momentum that leads us, once we've gotten to some point technologically, toward some second, more advanced level that may not be more advanced after all. To me, when you build a story, you are constructing a world, and as a result of that, you are putting together aspects synthetically of our world and potentially of others in experimental ways, in ways that are exploratory for the writer and also for the reader, especially for the reader of multiple stories or of the same story told multiple times in different ways, a sort of mythic tradition. So for me as a reader, certainly fiction and in particular folklore, fable, myth have been highly resonant. And also this has been a mode of expression for me. So I've written a couple novels. I've written a collection of stories that are, as you mentioned earlier, in the tradition of Talmudic legend. And these are, I think, contiguous with my practice, often considered to be artistic practice, because it tends to take place within the art world as simply a place that is permissive of the sorts of ideas I want to explore in the way that I want to explore them. I see it as contiguous, but also there being essential differences, namely that there are reasons why storytelling in the form of a book or in the form of an oral tradition, that is very useful and is a great means by which to direct people through some vision, some specific place that then at the end of that, you become perhaps more aware of the place that you came from, the place where you ordinarily are.
Kind of an idea filters in a certain kind of sense.
Yes, a possible world, and a possible world in a very specific way, in the form of a fully furnished experience, or as much so as possible. Whereas the other aspect of what I do that I think is very much related to it, but also has advantages and disadvantages as far as what I just described and the degree to which it achieves that, is this idea of the thought experiment in the form of instantiating a possible world for people to experience in an open-ended, non-deterministic way. So you have a beginning, middle, and end to a story generally, unless you're doing a choose-your-own-adventure.
Yeah.
And those were highly successful
those
in their time.
I
but nevertheless, most stories have that sort of structure. And I think the reason why they do is that they work very well in terms of serving that purpose of a whole experience that can be used comparatively to the world in which we live, a utopia, a dystopia, these sorts of genres. But in the case of this more open-ended approach to a parallel world, it allows for anything to happen and for interactions within that possible world to potentially become models for interaction out in the world in which we live. It is a space apart, but it's a space apart with the very deliberate attempt to make it, except in certain highly rigorous ways, different from our world, essentially similar to it in a way that we can then find our way back, so to speak.
I was curious, just on a practical level, you do a lot of writing, you do criticism, you've written many books. How does an experimental philosopher make a living? Like, I guess my question is...
You tell me.
Yeah. You know, has finding your way in the world professionally, and it's just a basic sense of eating and paying your rent and things like that, been difficult? I mean, many, many artists struggle with that. And I just wonder, from a really basic sense, how you monetize your art and practice, and or if you supplement with writing and other things like that.
Well, rent control goes a long way. But I would say that it is because I don't have any specialization, because essentially I have become a full-time dilettante, that I'm able to operate in enough worlds simultaneously that somehow I make rent. I write for magazines, often on science and technology. So I've written for Wired magazine for many years on language and language and technology. And I also have written for Discover magazine and a number of other magazines that are certainly at the level of how well they pay for right. the amount of time expended and the certainty with which they do so, certainly a much surer bet than going off and thinking and having some notion of a thought experiment without any idea of where it will take place and having a 5-year gestation period. Yet I think that they are all, once again, at least in my own mind, very much linked. One allows me the time to do the other, but it's also the resources. It's also the information. It's also the exposure. Writing is a way of thinking for me. Thinking is going to lead me to other writing. Curiosity really is at the core of all of it. And so curiosity that is expended in the process of developing a thought experiment often will lead me to a subject that is journalistically compelling. And these can work together potentially toward some larger project, which is my own project, and which is the project that I hope through what I do I can, if not inspire others to, but at least that I can put out there as something that I think is of value, is this project of maintaining and pursuing actively a curiosity about everything.
And which speaks to the dilettantism.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. This term dilettante is now used in a pejorative way, and so too is amateur. The amateur, to me, still has at least some of that older sense of its being about doing something out of the
love. Think about how George Plimpton, for example, embraced the term amateur back in the 1950s and 60s and beyond. You know, he embraced it and said, I want to go play with the New York Philharmonic and play the triangle for one day. I want to play football. I want to do all these things. And no one blamed him or said, hey, why would you want to do this? He said, I'm collecting experiences. I'm gathering information. I'm an anthropologist of the human existence.
But it was that last line, and it was the fact that he was writing about it that somehow, I think, made it
justified
in the minds of many. I find that it is much easier for me to explain myself, so to speak, to a relative or to a stranger in terms of what I do if I'm a writer. Okay, so writing is something that people read writing. They know what a writer does, and Plimpton, writing about his experiences, was able, in a sense, to redeem them in the popular view. Happily, that was never why he did what he did, and happily, the writings maintain the spirit in which he was working and thinking, and I think that, therefore, they had this broader impact. But certainly, it is not easy to go about this, and I don't mean only in the financial sense, which is not easy in its own right, but it is not easy also in the sense of the fact that in society today, doing something that does not have any immediate or obvious practical output is considered with a great degree of suspicion. That is both the difficulty And also for me, the motivation for doing what I do is that I think that it is worthwhile, and I think that others can be brought around to remembering, really, that it's worthwhile, because as children, we all knew that it was worthwhile. We all did this. I simply haven't bothered to grow up, and I would like to bring others back to
that. I think it's
great.
I think, you know, in some sense, you've kind of figured out a way to be a professional daydreamer in a certain sense. I think it's interesting. You talked about cobbling together these different things. It's very modern in a sense, because we keep hearing this term, the gig economy, where everybody kind of now, no one has one job anymore and everybody's kind of doing 10 things and they're selling stuff on Etsy, but they have a day job, but then sometimes they're Ubering at night. They do all these different things to kind of exist in the modern world. You present yourself in some of your writings and even in your physical appearance as a man who seems of a different time. Maybe I'm mistaking that, but there's a certain anachronism presented here. You don't have a cell phone, is that right?
No, I don't.
Have you ever had one?
I have never had a cell phone or a car, for that matter.
Or a car. And I wonder, here's my question. You talk a lot about technology and you talk a lot about this concept of the future, but at the same time, there's this element of you that comes off as you were born in the wrong time. And I wonder, do you see those things as mutually exclusive?
I don't see myself as having been born at the wrong time. I simply see myself as someone who decides what he wants to make use of within the world in which we live. And often that means opting out, not out of some sort of a general principle necessarily, but maybe at some meta level, perhaps there is some general principle there that is inherent in my thinking and also in what I do, which is this sort of ability to stand outside of the operating system of our society in order to be able to make decisions that are personal in terms of what I want to do and how I want to go about it, but ultimately also that are, perhaps more importantly, that are political in the sense of how it is as a society that we do not end up in a race to the bottom, where we don't end up in some sort of a momentum guiding us, but rather have the ability to envision other possibilities. So when you say that I am, in a sense, a professional daydreamer, I think that that is absolutely valid. I think that maybe where my daydreaming differs from others is that I try to find ways in which to bring others into my dreams, not because
make them manifest in some way.
Right. Not because they're better than other dreams, but simply because I think that for the most part, people are trying to shut out those dreams. And so if I can provide some sort of a model, even if it isn't a good one, even if it's just some notion of something that gets out in the world and is amusing enough even for somebody to pay attention to by way of some random contact through a newspaper article, that even that moment of contact with this sort of daydreaming.
Like a welcome mat for aliens, for example, or something like that.
Well, yes, a cosmic welcome mat certainly probably falls under the category of news of the weird, I think is sometimes what this gets called, but done absolutely rigorously. I undertook the project of creating this welcome mat out of what I believe to be a genuine need, originally out of a thought experiment or out of a conversation, really, from around the year 1950 between the great physicist Enrico Fermi and some of his fellow scientists who were talking about how the universe must be teeming with intelligence. And Fermi simply saying, well, where is everybody? And this was deeply distressing and has remained so within the search for extraterrestrial intelligence ever since then, as kind of a reminder of what has not been achieved and as a sort of grand ambition. But most of the effort as a result of that has gone toward more powerful radio telescopes or putting
a golden record onto an explorer and sending it out into the universe.
Right. And so my thought was, well, where is everybody? I were an alien. Would I come here? would I feel welcome? And I realized, well, aliens just south of the border certainly don't feel welcome. In general, there is a xenophobia in our society. There is a sense in our society of tribalism and a way in which an alien would probably not feel welcome in the first place. And so that led me to think about what might be a technology to bring about a higher level of welcomeness, a greater sense of welcome. And I realized we had that technology, which is the welcome mat. So I just redesigned the welcome mat in universal terms by thinking about the unknowns, biologically, cognitively, experientially, and how to work around them in terms of designing a welcome mat that would be truly universal in terms of its language. And the result of that, this cosmic welcome mat, was in its most immediate form, a physical welcome mat that was put out at the International Astronautical Congress, which then led to all sorts of news coverage in papers around the world. And that also, I think, at a more interesting level, has resulted in, and may potentially to a greater extent result in, this welcome mat as a means by which to find some deeper connection here on Earth with those we consider to be alien, to effectively transcend the xenophobia. If we can do so at some level with Andromeda, perhaps that can be a basis for doing so with Mexico. And if this cosmic welcome mat is welcoming to aliens from Andromeda, maybe also it can be welcoming to people, to refugees, to people from other countries. So there is a very immediate and, I believe, a very practical dimension to a thought experiment, to a daydream, to a notion that is somewhat out there, to say the least.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by the confused response, huh? Let's face it, folks, conceptual art isn't for everyone. And it isn't meant to be. Sometimes, despite your best efforts, you just end up saying, huh? Sometimes that's exactly what the artist intended. And that's okay. Because in some cases, if you ponder the possibilities long enough, you might even get from huh to hmm. Now that's progress.
Now that you know, as you mentioned, you're in many different spaces, but, you know, you're in the art world, you've done projects with museums, you've written about art extensively. I wonder two things. Where do you see yourself in the broader art world, and how are you welcomed within it? Because it is a clique in and of itself. The other thing is this, the projects that you do oftentimes are misunderstood by their very nature. They have reactions that are polarized, to say the least. Some people think they're amazing. Some people hate them.
Especially a silent ringtone.
Yeah.
Most controversial project of all time, remixing John Cage's 433.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder this, and this is just a real question. When we had the opportunity to bring you here, we were very excited about it. We had some people kind of saying, you know, this guy's not the real deal. You know, people were throwing out all kinds of interesting words like fraud and con and things like that. And I wonder if that's something you deal with a lot, and if it's because, and if you think it's because of the emotions that these projects elicit, and if that in some ways makes you happy because they worked, because they did create such response.
Well, from the very first project that I did, which was thinking for 24 hours and then selling my thoughts as artwork, that resulted in an article in the San Francisco Chronicle that then got a letter to the editor calling me a con artist. So really from the very beginning.
So that's been there from day one.
That has been. And that has never bothered me at the level of people might not like what I do. But on the other hand, I am seeking to reach as broad an audience as possible. And the animosity perhaps is not as constructive as the laughter, for instance. And I think that maybe it is simply a matter of persistence. It's a matter of this very long process of appearing in people's world, here and there, different ways through different means of expression, that many may not resonate. Many may result in blowback, as you say, but some of them may not. And even those that do, I have to believe that that's not all that is going on, that there can be an immediate reaction and then there can be a longer term response. And I don't have any means scientifically of being able to prove that point, but I think that it is a bet that I am willing to make, because the alternative would simply be to give up and to allow the world to persist as it is right now without making any effort to change it in any way. In terms of your question about the art world, I entered into the art world completely incidentally as far as my own practice as an experimental philosopher, which was a term that, as I said at the very beginning of this, is one that I came around to only later in this practice as a shorthand for what I do that ultimately is utterly non-informative and results in more questions and therefore seems to serve my purpose very well. I entered into the art world tentatively out of opportunity, really. So I had studied philosophy, had left academia, and was looking for space in which to be able to undertake thought experiments, not in the sense of a smuggled argument that is written on the page, but in the sense of a genuine experiment that is undertaken out in the world, constructing some alternate reality, some parallel universe, having others enter into it with me, and then discovering through that process as much as we can about the world in which we live. That was something that happened to, for some people, seem vaguely reminiscent of performance art and of installation art. And I've always been very interested in art and have spent a long time writing about it, looking at it, thinking about it. But it was certainly not an ambition or a plan on my part to enter into the art world. And it has been since that point, which was in around the year 2000, through a gallery in San Francisco called Refuse Salon, which in the same letter to the editor that I was called a con artist was referred to as Garbage Salon, that from that point forward, there's always been an uncomfortable relationship with the art world in its purest form, a sort of skepticism on both sides, perhaps, certainly on the side of the art world that what I'm doing is legitimately art or legitimate in the first place. And to me, if it were to fall under the category of art so perfectly as not to have that blowback, I would be doing something wrong. So I take that to be a sign that I'm doing something right. But I think also, as that may suggest, that I have certain hesitation and skepticism as well, that I think that the art world is by and large, too self-defining and narrow, and that it reaches an audience that is too exclusive for what I want to achieve in the world, that it ultimately has, by way of factors ranging from how the art market works to how institutions are typically in spaces that do not really interact with or simply are not proximate to most people, that as a result of that, the art world has an insularity to it that is not at all the same as, but somehow parallel to the insularity of academia, of academic philosophy. And I really don't want to buy into that. Well, at the same time, I see so much great art, first of all, and so much happening in the art world that is really remarkable, and that there is, at some opportunistic level on both sides, I think, something to be gained through a relationship with the art world and through the art world being a space in which I undertake my thought experiments, a part of this larger practice within the art world of putting art into the world, and a larger practice on my part of trying to instill curiosity and to bring people into other ways of thinking about themselves and their society.
Thinking about all that you've done, and you've done so much, and it's been very willed. You've willed many of these things into existence from nothing, from concept to creation. I think that is what we were talking about, the idea of this thing between the professional daydreamer, but the, also the kind of person that can make those things into a reality, and how do you meld those things? I wonder, just to finish up, if you view in some ways your biggest creation as yourself. So is Jonathan Keats, experimental philosopher, at the end of the day, the creation in some ways that you're most proud of?
I suspect that some may see it that way. I certainly don't, and I certainly would do whatever I possibly can to avoid that because, well, on the one hand, it seems rather egotistical. But on the other hand, more importantly, it then seems like somewhat of a dead end. Essentially, it becomes myself as a sort of a sculpture that can be put on a pedestal and set aside. I am interested in doing what I do because it is a way in which to live and because it is potentially a way in which others might want to live as well. And furthermore, because it is how I think, at least at some level, we all need to live if we are to live in a democratic society where we are informed and capable of deciding our future collectively. So I see what I do on one level is selfish, certainly, that I get to pursue my curiosity. And maybe in that sense, the greatest product of all this, the ultimate end game, is some sort of self-enrichment. Maybe that's not such a bad thing. But the more significant part, I like to think at least, of what I do is on the outside of who I am, and simply is that who I am allows me to serve roles within the world that allow thought experiments to take place, that allow these projects to take place. I often speak of the fact that I'm the cheapest laborer around, so I will employ myself to do whatever needs to be done, and that has run the gamut from, as you mentioned, designing a cosmic welcome mat to making pornography for houseplants to very wide gamut of projects, selling real estate in the dimensions of space posited by string theory, going into all of these businesses kind of in the way that I already was doing when I was selling rocks out on the street. This is a way in which I'm part of the furniture. I'm part of the infrastructure that allows these experiments to take place. And the experiments themselves need to be greater than I am for them to be worthwhile in the first place.
So the aliens come back tomorrow, and you've got your cosmic welcome mat out.
Which aliens?
Any aliens from outer space. We don't know who yet, but they say some show up.
So not in the sense that you and I are alien to each other.
No. These would be someone, let's say people from Mars, or creatures from Mars that we didn't know existed. They decide to visit tomorrow. They come to your house. You have your welcome mat out, but they are not responsive to it, and they just decide to incinerate us, Marvin the Martian style, with a ray gun. And here lies Jonathan Keats. What do you want, you know, if we can say on, you know, one line about, you know, the work and things you've done, what is that thing? What is the kind of summation of, would you like to use that opportunity to create another thought experiment? Or, you know, would you want to have someone have to try to sum you up in an epitaph?
I think that the incineration would be really a part of the thought experiment that I've already started by way of trying to create a cosmic welcome mat. Every project that I do is out of control at some level. I don't know what will happen. I don't know what will become of it. Meaning emerges in that way. So if I can facilitate the emergence of meaning, maybe that's the epitaph, then I have accomplished something in this life.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. Till I get to the bottom and I see you again.
Like so many public spaces in American life, museums have not been exempt from the specter of gun violence. On June 10, 2009, an 89-year-old self-proclaimed white supremacist and Holocaust denier shot and killed a security guard at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. The shooter, wounded by return fire from two other guards, died while awaiting trial. On November 29, 2015, a man named Dean Sturgis walked into the Wexner Arts Center on the campus of Ohio State University and began shooting and spray-painting art, sending bullets through walls. He threatened several guards, and after destroying more art and waving his gun around, Sturgis sat down in a chair, turned the gun on himself, and took his own life. Sturgis worked as a campus security guard at Ohio State until 2009. He resigned in anticipation of being fired after numerous sexual harassment complaints. His last position had been at the museum. Recalling his departure, a former coworker said, "He left with a threat, saying he would be back with a gun one day, and we wouldn't like it." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.